Arsenal for Democracy is available twice a week. There's a free episode at arsenalfordemocracy.com or Apple or Stitcher each weekend, and a midweek bonus episode at patreon.com/arsenalfordemocracy, available for $5 a month. The show is recorded and produced by me, Bill Humphrey, in Newton, Massachusetts. Our theme music is produced by Stunt Bird. Follow us on Facebook or at AFD Radio on Twitter. The show is not affiliated with any campaign committee, and each participant's opinions are their own.
This land is your land. This land is my land. California, the New York Island, the Redwood Forest, the Gulf Stream waters. This land was made for you and me.
You're listening to Arsenal for Democracy, episode 359, recorded on Monday, March 15th, 2021. I'm your host, Bill Humphrey. Joining me on the bonus episode this week is Rachel. Hello, Rachel.
Hi, Bill.
In this week's bonus episode, we're talking about Samuel Milton Golden Rule Jones, a progressive industrialist and the eccentric Christian socialist reform mayor of Toledo from 1897 until 1904. You might recall that we talked about the Toledo Autolite strike of 1934 on a recent episode, number 338 from December 2020, and I think we speculated in passing that his legacy at the turn of the century, after the previous biggest economic depression, might have influenced some of the public solidarity for striking workers during the astronomical local unemployment of the Great Depression. We also speculated that his police reforms, like taking away their truncheons, might have had some lasting influence as well, but we weren't sure on that point. We've also talked on previous episodes, number 316 from July 2020, about other rich progressive industrialists who entered politics, like Detroit Mayor and Michigan Governor Hazen S. Pingree, who was a contemporary of Samuel M. Jones less than 100 miles away. While Pingree was a shoemaking tycoon of old New England Yankee stock, Jones was a Welsh-born oilman who immigrated as a toddler and got wealthy in the 1860s as a worker and then financial speculator in the northwestern Pennsylvania oil rush that we devoted several episodes to last year, numbers 305 through 309 from May 2020, in exploring the origins of Rockefeller's Standard Oil monopoly. One of the major features of Standard Oil's monopolization was buying out the competition for a very good deal if willing and a much less favorable deal if unwilling. Jones's oil company, eventually centered in Ohio like Rockefeller's operations rather than in Pennsylvania, was one of those that sold to Rockefeller for a windfall, including for Jones specifically. He eventually relocated to Toledo, Ohio, just ahead of the national economic depression that would last from 1893 to 1897, and he was shocked by the poverty of the large number of unemployed masses in the greater Lucas County area during this crisis. He decided to turn his knowledge and money toward developing and producing technological innovations for the oil industry, which could be produced in Toledo to create jobs. It would also give him a chance to voluntarily put into practice his progressive views on how factories should be governed.
So we're pulling from a few different sources describing his factory. So from PBS.org, the American Experience Program, they had a short little digital video about Samuel M. Jones, and I'm just quoting from the transcript here. By the time he was 40, Samuel M. Jones was already a wealthy man. When he patented an improved oil pumping mechanism, his fortune grew larger. In 1892, Jones moved to Toledo, Ohio, a city soon plagued by economic depression, as Bill just mentioned. He opened a factory to manufacture his oil pump and vowed to treat his workers ethically. Jones sought an efficient yet moral workplace. Factory workers got eight-hour workdays, paid vacations, child care assistance, subsidized meals, above-average wages, and profit sharing. And he had a sign posted in his factory saying, "The rule that governs this factory, therefore whatsoever ye would that men should do unto you, do ye even so unto them." And this is how Samuel Jones earned the nickname Golden Rule Jones. Eventually, Samuel Jones was elected as mayor of Toledo. And apparently the sign with the golden rule was the only posted conduct rule for employees in the facility. And Jones's company for manufacturing his patented device was hilariously called the Acme Sucker Rod Company. And it was a rod for more efficiently pumping oil out of the oiled wells. And this comes from the ToledoLibrary.org blog. Unlike any other business at the time, the Acme Sucker Rod Factory provided education and entertainment for employees and their families. The factory compound contained the Golden Rule Park, used for Sunday outings and lectures, and a kindergarten classroom was established to give young children of employees a head start in education and to teach children to respect all others. And Samuel Jones was also a believer in promoting physical fitness. The ToledoLibrary.org blog does have a few photos where he's kind of showing the kids his moves and promoting like calisthenics and physical fitness.
Now we turn to his career in municipal politics in Toledo after he was a prominent industrialist, a progressive industrialist, I guess you would call it. So we turn now to the National Historical Publications and Records Commission and the Ohio Historical Society collection of the Samuel Milton Jones papers. Quote, known as Golden Rule Jones, he was an influential advocate of municipal reform and oversaw implementation of a series of humane modifications, including free kindergartens, a park system, playgrounds for children, free public baths, an 8-hour workday for public city workers, and other reforms. According to the Britannica entry, his guide in dealing with employees, Jones attested, was the Golden Rule, and admirers and critics alike, many businessmen despised him as a supposed socialist, applied that term as his sobriquet. Nominated by the Republican Party and elected in 1897 as mayor of Toledo, he set about governing by the same ideal. He established free kindergartens and playgrounds and free lodging for the homeless. He granted city employees benefits comparable to those his factory workers enjoyed. He sought to root out corruption from city government, and he advocated public ownership of utilities. The Ohio Historical Society website largely repeats what the other sources have already mentioned, except to clarify more on his role in the oil industry, which I mentioned at the top. But it also notes that Jones encouraged voters and politicians to renounce political parties. He believed that nonpartisan politics would unite the American people together rather than divide them, as political parties seem to do. And interestingly, that was something that was a common feature in other places that we've talked about previously on other episodes, like in Minnesota, around the same time period or shortly thereafter as well. But there's also a specific reason that he was promoting leaving behind the traditional two-party system as part of his efforts. And I'll quote now from the Wikipedia article. These policies, as mayor, made Jones unpopular with the Toledo business community, and his tolerance of saloons caused him to lose the support of many moral reformers. When his first term was over in 1899, Jones was not renominated by the Republicans. He ran as an independent instead under the slogan Principle Before Party, winning a second term with 70% of the vote. He was reelected to a third term in 1901 with 57% of the vote, and again in 1903 with 48% of the vote in a three-way race. Golden Rule Jones died suddenly during his fourth term as mayor on July 12, 1904. Citizens of Toledo lined the streets to view his funeral procession. And that quotes from a 1999 Toledo Blade article headlined, City Flourished Under Golden Rule of Jones. And interestingly as well, his successor, Brand Whitlock, continued Jones's reform efforts. So his efforts did not die with him.
There's also a contemporary quote on the Wikipedia article from Jones, published in 1899, which gives insight into his highly unusual socioeconomic and political philosophy, especially for wealthy capitalists. Quote, is not machinery a social product, the result of centuries of experiment and invention? In short, is not our whole civilization essentially a social product? Back of every inventor stands 1,000 others who made his invention possible. Back of every enterprising capitalist stands the entire nation, without which not one of his schemes could succeed. No man can point to his pile of gold and say, alone I earned it. What is called socialism is not a visionary plan for remodeling society. It is a present fact, which is not yet recognized in the distribution of wealth. And this comes from Samuel M. Jones, The New Right, published in 1899. So that kind of brings to mind the Obama quote for which he was kind of drug through the mud, the you didn't build that on your own or whatever. But I'm guessing he didn't raise as much ire as President Obama did with his quote. There's also a quote from historian Robert M. Crunden. Golden Rule Jones was one of the genuine eccentrics in American history. Physically, he gave the impression of a man both strong and innocent, with large blue eyes that could transfix an audience or an interviewer. He was also genial, yet earnest and completely humorless. He was a self-made American businessman who, for some unknown reason, decided that business, politics, and religion were somehow all the same, and spent the last decade of his life trying to convince others. In part, his progressivism was serious, as when he campaigned for public control of natural monopolies, like the trolley or electricity. At other times, it was quite frivolous, although he would never have admitted it. He should be remembered as a rather extreme example of the naive, religious side of progressivism, inspiring people rather than accomplishing very much.
So, Rachel, I want to think now about sort of how we should view his legacy, at least based on the sources that we've presented tonight and some of these quotes both from him and about him. I agree with you. There's obviously the you didn't build that comparison, but it's also interesting his view on sort of his utopian ideal for society with that quote, what is called socialism is not a visionary plan for remodeling society. It is a present fact, which is not yet recognized in the distribution of wealth, meaning that that is how society is supposed to function, but the distribution of wealth is distorting that and failing to recognize that sort of communal spirit, that team effort that he was so fascinated by, which is also interesting, I think, for, you know, this tech inventor with patents and so forth.
Right. I think it's interesting that he did have a profit sharing scheme. I'm not entirely sure what it entailed, but I think he was trying as best he could to do right by the workers. But still, I mean, he didn't hand over the means of production to them. So he was still making his fortune off of their labor. So it's, I think his heart was in the right place, but I don't know. He didn't quite go far enough in giving power to the workers. So while it was very nice that he had all those perks, and they're great perks, even by today's standards, especially with like the childcare assistance and subsidized meals and whatnot, like he didn't quite make it to that socialist standard, even though his detractors kind of put that on him.
I think there's three specific points that I wanted to bring up for people to consider as we're, you know, listing off these things that definitely sound like, as you said, nice perks from the employment side of his, you know, business activities, and certainly some nice policies that we could wish for today from his municipal policies, right? Many cities have gone backward since this sort of phase of municipalism. The three points that I want people to consider. First of all, obviously, you know, I don't know him personally. Maybe he wasn't this strange, eccentric weirdo, but he does seem a little bit strange. You know, maybe that's just propaganda or whatever. However, regardless of whether or not he was eccentric and strange, it's indisputable that he was still a capitalist, that he made his fortune off of exploitation, right? He worked his way up through the oil industry and, you know, engaged in various financial speculation in that industry after originally working as the sort of equivalent of a field hand. We talked about those sort of low-level laborers that worked in the early oil rush. And then eventually he, you know, makes his big fortune off of selling out to Rockefeller with all that sort of entails. And I don't know if that was a complete buyout or there were some people that Rockefeller did buy, you know, partnerships with where they were basically still collecting money for years off of that, even if they were no longer involved in the company's operations. There's more ambiguity around his exploitation once he actually gets to the factory production stuff that, you know, Rachel was just talking about, right? Profit sharing and so forth. You know, maybe that's a little bit less exploitation, although still exploitation of the workers. But that brings me to the second point. Were the higher wages than the prevailing wages, were these extra benefits and perks, were these profit sharing schemes only possible because of specifically what he was producing, which was a patented device, right? He can say that, you know, all he wants that, oh, these inventions are only possible through the previous inventions and all these, you know, it's, as the quote goes, no man stands, you know, alone, but on the shoulders of all those who have gone before him and so forth, right? There's various quotes to that effect that he seems to have broadly agreed with. But at the end of the day, he's not competing with other companies because he's making a patented device and he's benefiting from the revenues off of a patented unique device that he quote unquote invented. We don't know the specifics on that. I don't know that if he was producing a more generic piece of equipment without patent protections, if he would have been able quote unquote to offer through the generosity of heart, all of these perks and things and profit sharing that he gave out, right? Because he's probably making quite a premium on that. Third point. So we've established at this point that he was quite a rich guy, right? He's not Rockefeller rich, but he was quite a rich individual at the time. And we talked about how, you know, the Blue Laws promoters cast him aside. The Toledo business community really didn't like him, and that he mostly was relying on this huge popular support and not even really able after the first election to count on the support of the local political parties. Okay, fine. But again, was that also only possible because he was rich? That political platform and that independence, was that possible because he was this rich tycoon? Now, we've talked about other people, you know, in the upper Midwest and so forth who were, you know, able to have relatively progressive political careers and so forth with varying levels of independence from the party machines, and in some cases being sort of more involved with third party politics and things like that. But one of the common themes, though not exclusively true for all of them, one of the common themes seems to be this sort of independent wealth. And so I was wondering, Rachel, what your thoughts were on those sort of 3 points.
Yeah, I think if you have wealth, obviously you have a lot more freedom to operate outside of the political machines. Like, you're not beholden to donors or the elite party leaders that are able to kind of swing their wealth around to get their way. So yeah, I think his independence was possible in large part because he had his own wealth and he didn't have to capitulate to their platform because he was so wealthy. And to your second point, yeah, I think he could offer those perks to his workers because he was manufacturing such a unique device. He wasn't competing with anyone. Therefore, there wasn't that race to maximize profit, potentially at the expense of the workers, just to edge out the competition and get ahead by reducing that overhead and reducing the price of your product that you have to compete with other manufacturers. So I think his circumstances were fairly uncommon, and that did kind of allow him to live out his morals, I guess. Yeah, he was able to provide for his workers just because he was kind of had that money, so he could have that noblesse oblige kind of thing where he could provide for his workers in kind of a more like paternalistic sort of way, like opening the kindergarten for the children and stuff. He could really, really be paternalistic and fatherly and avuncular because he had that wealth and that independence.
I do think that it's worth acknowledging that, like, at least he seems like he was nicer than some of the other paternalist industrialists, because, like, you know, all those, I mean, you had a bunch of those early 20th century psycho factory owner guys, you know, whether it was at the Pullman Company in the late 19th century or Henry Ford in the early 20th century, who, you know, had a sort of utopian vision for how they wanted things to run. And that was not necessarily for the benefit of the workers, but they had this, you know, they imposed that on the workers. This seems to at least be, like, as far as those schemes go, genuinely in the interests of the workers and probably making their lives substantially better. And yeah, I think it's also reflected in the fact that, like, he was propelled to the political office at the end of this depression period in Toledo. Again, we're referring to the depression in the 1890s rather than the Great Depression. So clearly people were into it, right, from that standpoint. And then he enacted clearly a very popular agenda as mayor. So he's, like, on the good end of that spectrum, but I think he's still on that same continuum.
Yeah, I think one aspect that definitely separates him from those other industrialists is his religiosity. Like, he did kind of identify with that Christian socialist philosophy, and I think that's definitely something that shaped his morals and kind of shaped How he treated his workers and how he benefited the citizens of Toledo. So that's something that the source material just kind of mentioned in passing. So it would be really interesting to kind of see.
To look at those papers, for example, from the Jones collection.
Right. Yeah, exactly. To kind of see how his religiosity influenced him. And I think it's kind of interesting that we've talked about a couple of Christian socialists over the past few episodes, because that's kind of a tendency that isn't really talked about as much today in socialist circles. You don't really hear about the Christian socialists as much, but I think that is kind of something that's really interesting, because the Christianity like informs the socialism. So that would kind of be worth looking into, I think, some other Christian socialists of the time.
Right. And I think that that also contrasts with some of those other businessmen who would also have considered themselves to be quite religious. I mean, some of them certainly did not consider themselves to be religious, but there were a bunch of the, you know, early multimillionaires and billionaires who were quite dour Calvinist type Protestants, and that shaped their sort of utopian views as well. It was just a very different specific strain of things.
Yeah. Well, and then also contrasted with what the religious right looks like today. Like, their Christianity definitely doesn't inform their political philosophy towards socialism. So it's kind of interesting that the religious right has kind of taken over the broad swath of Christianity in America, for the worse, obviously.
All right. Well, we've had a few long episodes recently, so we figured we would release a shorter bonus episode this week for our listeners, not to mention that I happen to have a very packed schedule myself, so this was about all we could squeeze in. But just a really fascinating guy to talk about, even in brief, and I'm glad that we finally got back to him after sort of passing glancingly across him in that Toledo Autolike Strike episode. So, Rachel, thank you so much for being on the bonus episode this week to talk about Samuel Milton Golden Rule Jones, the mayor of Toledo at the turn of the last century.
Thanks. It was a pleasure.